I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast, episode 31. Welcome back to the Pure Green Podcast. I took an impromptu break over the summer, and I hope you're still with me. This summer was a big one. I feel like it will be one of those defining times in my life. There was lots to work through and understand, and a big part of me broke away and evolved. I spent most of my days with Charlie, who's now 2.5, and for the first time in years, I feel as though I actually had a summer. But I'm thrilled to be coming back with a fantastic interview. One of the things I love best about Pure Green is the larger community of creative people that we're a part of. And a shining star in that community is today's guest, Renee of the blog Will Frolic for Food. Renee is known for her beautiful, inspired writing, her excellent photography and styling. But what I love best about her blog is that it's joyful. Just read her about section, you'll see what I mean. Everything Renee writes about and creates feels decadent, like you're treating yourself, despite the fact that her recipes focus on super healthy, plant-based food. It's never about depriving yourself from Renee's blog, and flavor takes the driver's seat. Renee is a well-balanced, beautiful person, and I was excited to talk to her about her creative life and passions. She reveals a lot about herself in the interview, and perhaps best of all, she's very real, admitting fully that life wasn't always so easy and providing lots of tools to help move through difficult times. We talk about her blog, her dedication to her yoga practice, and then chocolate too, as Renee is also part of Frolic Chocolate, a bean-to-bar startup chocolate company. Renee is also a contributor to Pure Green, and most notably, she's a community leader for the summer phase of the Pure Green in Season cookbook, which, by the way, we're currently accepting submissions for. So if you're a food blogger or writer, go to puregreenmag.com/puregreeninseason for details. Okay, let's dive right in. It's a great episode. Here's Renee. So my first question for you is that, and this is kind of a question that's coming from me personally, because one of the themes that I find has risen in my own personal life is how to release myself from stress. Mm-hmm. I've woken up as a wife, an entrepreneur, and a parent, and I realize, you know, only to realize that I feel consumed by stress, yeah, and it's getting in the way of everything. Yeah. You know, it's no way to live, and rather than just accept that this is the way things are, I find that I'm closely examining kind of my deepest motivations, my emotions, my desires, in order to uncover just a path of lesser resistance. So I find I've become extremely interested and aware of others who seem to have chosen that path of least resistance in order to live more freely. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a function of looking in from the outside, but it seems like this describes you, Renee. Oh.
Yeah, I think so. I suppose so. I definitely feel like I consider myself able to handle and withstand stress in a really effective way. I just feel like I have a lot of tools to deal with it, and have absorbed a lot from my many life experiences to deal with stress. And part of that is that my family has a lot of anxiety issues.
So you said your family has lots of anxiety issues, and you developed tools. What would some of those tools be?
Well, a lot of them orient, I feel like, around having developed a really solid understanding of improvisation and how that technique works in theater. You act completely in the present moment, and you receive whatever impetus or, you receive the story of whatever's happening around you, and you respond authentically, and you say yes. So you try to find positive ways to deal with whatever situation has presented itself to you. So in times of stress, especially when I was younger, I used to use that principle to try to sort of circumnavigate any potentially like negative experiences to turn them into more positive experiences. Does that make sense? A lot of the tools that I've developed, I feel I've developed also partially based around things that I learned while I was hiking when I was younger. I went on a really long hike when I was 20 to Spain. And I hiked for a month through all of Spain. I just backpacked, basically.
That's amazing.
I mean, it was an incredible, life-changing, life-affirming trip, and it helped me to deal with a lot of what was going on in my life, but it also helped me to develop tools to approach a lot of the stress and suffering that is natural to living a life as an emotional human, some of which include reorienting my awareness of how stressful situations affect me personally and taking a step back from them in order to approach them without particularly having a very intense emotional reaction as much as it is like accepting the situation and approaching it just trying to say to myself basically like, okay, this is happening and now I'm going to deal with this. I'm just going to deal with it as it is. And not allow my emotional reaction to make it too difficult for me to actually find a real solution to whatever stresses me out. And also I think like helping myself to approach things in my life which are causing me stress as, I don't know, I guess I'm a little selfish in a way in that I approach things that cause me stress as a little bit less valuable a lot of the time. You know, like this is destroying my happiness or taking joy away from me. How can I approach this in a way where I'm still like experiencing joy or happiness? Or otherwise, like, remove the impetus for this anxiety from my life. But not everything. You can't do that with everything. You just kind of have to approach things sometimes and accept and try to bring love and positivity into the situation and find solutions. But that was a really long answer.
Sorry. Well, it's a tricky question, but I loved your answer. I think that a lot of what causes us stress and the fact that it just builds is the fact that it builds up. You know, I think we compartmentalize, we file things away to deal with later, and it just never gets dealt with.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely try to deal with stressors as they arise, and definitely my meditation practice and yoga practice helps me to deal with things as they come up. I definitely don't think that suppressing your feelings about situations does anything to actually aid in the situation other than straight up survival, which is, to me, really the reason that we do that. We suppress to survive with sort of this intention that we'll go back and unfold all of these stressors later, but they just build up on top of each other and become intermingled and cause even more anxiety over the long term, and then you have to spend like years unpacking all of that.
It makes sense. It's kind of like all those books you mean to read but never do.
Right, yeah, they just keep collecting up and piling, and then but you never read them, so you just need to like slowly take each one in your hands and like, you know, ask yourself, does this, like, how can I deal with this particular stressor that happened to me in my life? Like, do I just need to accept that this happened and then move beyond it? Or is this something I really need to sit with and deal with? And sort of, I guess you would say, that same book analogy, just like slowly start to release those things. And
Yeah, that's actually a really good analogy. I think it's a good way of looking at it. So thank you for that answer, Renee. And so I'm sorry, I keep saying French is my first language. I'm so tempted to say Renee, but I'm sure that
Yeah, my dad speaks French fluently, so he...
Oh, so you're used to it.
Yeah, I mean, around the house, he would just speak French. Yeah. It's not his first language, it's his second language, but he's a brilliant, brilliant linguist, I guess you would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, I wanted you to take us into your world a little bit. So who is Renee, and what is your current life's work?
That's such a huge question. Both of those are so big. Who is Renee? I mean, I guess I could give you a lot of answers to that, but I'm a 26-year-old woman from Virginia, and I live in the mountains with my husband, and we don't have kids, and we don't have any pets. I have a garden, which I am very sort of lazy about, so thus didn't produce very much this year. And I teach yoga, and I'm a photographer, and I'm an artist and writer, and I have a lot of different works that I do as far as creative work is concerned. Mm-hmm. I come from a Navy family. Definitely would be remiss if I didn't include that. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge influence in my life. And my grandfather was a POW. I mean, how far do we want to go down this train? I mean, I can keep going on and on. And the work that I'm doing right now, especially with the blog, is very much so oriented around wellness and eating clean foods, you know, eating unprocessed foods and developing recipes that are inspiring and accessible and that make you feel really good and help you to sort of enjoy the experience of living. That's sort of my intention anyway.
Yeah, no, it comes off that way for sure. You're doing a great job.
I'm glad. And so the photography, I'm a self-taught photographer, so like that's something that I really enjoy and have delved into and also am expanding into or have been continuously expanding into professionally. So that's been really wonderful. And that's a lot of my work as well. Like as a photographer outside of the blog, the readers don't really get to see this very much, but I just love getting to explore like somebody's just beauty, you know, different body shapes, sizes, personalities. I just love getting to sit and explore somebody's being like behind a camera. It's so much fun. Just getting to capture them and making them feel really good and feel really beautiful. Oh my gosh. It's so great.
And that's hard to do, you know, bringing someone's beauty out through a camera, I think takes real talent. It's more of an instinct as opposed to a skill that you learn because it's hard to do.
Yeah, so. I think that it is. And I just sort of discovered photography a couple of years ago and have been very encouraged by a community of artists and photographers here in Charlottesville who are very, very welcoming, despite the fact that there are a lot of photographers in Charlottesville. Like, this is the second biggest wedding region on the East Coast of America. So there are so many photographers, an incredibly large amount. But it's been really like a blessing to be able to explore it and be supported by this community.
Yeah, I know that. And so you said that you're self-taught. So how did that process go for you? Like, did you have anyone to show you the basics, or did you just start experimenting and it eventually started to work?
It was a combination of both of those things. I had my friend Kelsey McNair of With Lavender and Lace, who is also really big on Instagram and just an awesome human. She's a really fantastic photographer, and she would occasionally sort of sit down with me and go over a couple of things really quick, and then I would just be like, oh my gosh, that's so fascinating. You know, she would like show me how to change the aperture and like a couple of different things about lenses, and I'd be like, whoa, that's so cool. And then but generally for photography, I learned a lot just by being a nerd and researching on the internet and like scoping out other people's styles and trying to figure out what they were doing, and I took a bunch of workshops and I mean, I took workshops, you know, so I'm not like, I didn't go to school for photography. I've tried to put myself into positions where I'm working with other photographers and can learn from them, from their process, or directly when they're like, hey, this is how you do this, you know. But other than that, a lot of my development as a photographer just comes from doing it pretty much every day and doing it every day for the past 2 years. Well, yeah, I've pretty much been doing it every day for the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that's taught me so much. But one thing that isn't talked about a lot about food photography is if you start out as a food photographer and you get to be, you know, comparably good between good and excellent, then it's going to teach you so much more about color and line and form, styling, how the eye moves along the actual image. And you can translate that into a very, like, easeful comfort behind the camera working with people, because you know, you just automatically know, like, intuitively the kinds of colors in the environment, the shapes that you want within the actual, like, image. I find that it's just a lot. I've learned so much from the process of food photography, translating to photographing people for portraits and weddings and stuff like that.
I find that really interesting because for me, I've kind of had the opposite experience, because when you're photographing food or another static element, you know, I find that I can control all those elements and I push things around and I can take my time and, you know, I don't feel the pressure of having to capture moments unfolding in real time right before my very eyes, and which you can manipulate to some degree, but not entirely. I find good photographers, excellent photographers, are able to just roll with it.
Oh, totally, yeah. Yeah, well, and part of that is, for me, a lot of, like, doing food photography and similarity between doing food photography and then doing a portraiture and stuff like that is that both, for me, are very much so also based in this idea of improvisation. Because I get into the kitchen and I'm not like, oh, I have this specific, you know, styling concept for this. Usually I'm just like, I've got all these props and I have this food and I guess we'll see what happens, you know, just like play with it until I find what I like. I don't, you know, usually get what I want on the first shot, but it's the same thing for me for shooting people. It's like, I'm going to show up in this place and just, I guess, figure out what we're working with and figure out what the space has got going on with it, and if we have any interesting sort of geometric spaces within the place that we're working, and if we can work with that, you know, and, like, how comfortable the person is. So it just has a lot to do, I guess, with, like, trying to find all the different tools in my environment to make images really interesting. So that, I guess, I'm, like, literally just thinking about this right now. But... But yeah.
So your experience then, like, since we're talking about photography, let's talk about your blog a little bit. So your evolution as a photographer is tied to the evolution of your blog. Yes. Or did it start independently of that?
Oh, definitely tied into the blog, most definitely. Okay. I mean, you can go back in the archives, which I don't really want you to do, but you can go back in the archives and see some really bad photography. It's pretty bad.
I'm sure it's not as bad as you think.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Well, good for you for leaving it there.
Oh my gosh, I've been so tempted to erase it. But I also feel like I don't just want to, like, I don't really want to be so inauthentic. Like, people can go see that. It's also a good example of, like, people don't just start out being good at stuff. They start somewhere. And it's usually messy and uncomfortable and, like, not as beautiful as they want it to be. And then they just grow over time. Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty good example. As much as I want to erase them, I don't.
Well, that's good. And you're so right. I mean, I think with the internet, it's just really created this tendency to be envious and of others, their talent and what they're doing, and forget that it is all part of a journey and that where they are on theirs may not match up with where you are, but that eventually you'll get there if you persevere, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, that's why I actually don't follow a lot of, like, fitness Instagrammers, for example, because it just, like, makes me feel really bad. It's just the constant comparison thing, you know? So, like, I'm like, go you, you're awesome, you are a badass, but I can't look at your stuff all the time because it makes me feel really, like, yeah, makes me feel not so great. Okay. Even though I'm not, like, unhealthy at all, I just, like, I don't want to be comparing myself to someone who's literal, like, every single day of their life is spent working out 3 hours a day.
Right, exactly.
So, it's unrealistic.
It is. Yeah, it often is. So, it sounds like then you came from an artistic background. So, at what point, like, where does your love of cooking and food come from?
I mean, my mom really instilled a lot of love of food in me growing up, like a lot of people. She is like the queen of improvising amazing meals out of nothing, or out of like seemingly disparate items. She'll have like, you know, vegetable stock and like broccoli and some ground pepper and like, you know, chicken when I was growing up or whatever, just like things that didn't really seem like they went together, and she'd make this amazing meal out of it. And it was always really sort of amazing to watch, although I didn't really know that that was different than other moms as a kid, but looking back on it, I'm just like, wow, that's so amazing. So she really like instilled a love of food, and a lot of it also comes from being shaped by my community. When I was in college, I was just surrounded by these amazing artists who just really loved food. Like, they loved food so much. And they were, at the time, pretty much everybody was vegetarian. So I was like, I guess I'll follow suit and be a vegetarian. So I became a vegetarian and just got to explore such amazing meals in wonderful communal events, like potlucks and hippie stuff like that, which I was and am definitely still involved in. But a lot of it came from that and from traveling, like eating food when you're in a different place to me is always just so like pleasurable. And part of that is that you're not used to your environment, so you're very, very present of the experience that you're having. So things can sometimes have that much more like pleasure oriented around them because you're so aware of what you're doing.
Yeah, and you're not just, like you said, you're aware and you're also not distracted.
Right.
The clutter of your everyday life.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I there are countless days that I just like, I'm basically like eating a bowl of some random thing, you know, like looking at my blog stats and like writing or reading, and I'm just like not being very present with it. But I don't like live this life where it's like every meal is perfect and beautiful and slow and aware and blah. I do love doing that. I do love setting down and experiencing those things. But yeah, a lot of my love of food comes from, I feel like, those three things, my mother and my community and traveling.
I'm still thinking about your, you know, thanks for that dose of reality where not every meal is perfect, because, you know, again, you forget that it, you know, your blog does make it look like that is your reality. So.
I know. I'm totally aware of the fact that I'm cultivating that. Mm-hmm. And it's really funny to me, but like, I mean, I don't want to look at blogs that are not attractive either.
No, of course.
But I know that, like, that blogger, you know, that blogger with the, you know, the beautiful ceramics and, like, fabulous bouquet on their kitchen counter and, like, you know, a randomly scattered antler, they typically have created that environment, and they're not just, like, sitting down to their meal of a poached egg and sauteed spinach, like, every morning with steam coming from their coffee cup, like, looking out the window gracefully with no distractions, alone. Like, that just doesn't happen. Like, there are toddlers running around in the background, and there's, like, you know, ketchup splattered on the wall. It's just, like, not in the photograph, and they don't talk about it. And, I mean, I know that my kitchen is usually, like, wrecked. Behind the scenes of like a photo shoot, behind me there's like pie crumbs all over the counter and like forks splayed everywhere because I'm just like in the midst of making this thing. But I don't really turn the camera around to look at the rest of the space because I want people to feel like a sense of ease and calm when they look at the photos, like a sense of proportion and beauty. But that's not real life most of the time.
No, but it's like you said, I think just providing that escape sometimes is just a reminder to make a bit more of an effort.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, you know, even if it's trying to be, you know, like not watch TV at the same time as you eat or something small like that. And the more you can appreciate beauty, I think the more beauty there is in your life.
Well, too. I totally agree with that. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, actually.
Yeah, me too. So you had said that why you went vegetarian initially was because you were influenced by your community.
Yep.
So is that like the main reason that you chose to write mostly plant-based and to cater to special diets like, you know, like gluten-free or different things like that? Like you talk about that a little bit in your sort of in your about section on your blog.
Yeah.
So like, why did you stick with it?
Well, mostly I stick with it because I eat that way. Mostly. I eat a lot of plants. I eat a lot of plant-based foods. I do eat vegan about, like, I mean, right now, like, 99% of the time. Not really intentionally. I just haven't really been feeling like eating eggs a lot lately. But I do eat other plant, I mean, like, eggs and goat cheese and stuff. But, yeah, I have some food sensitivities, which are probably arguably minor compared to like real, really intense sort of anaphylactic responses, but they do make me feel more ill. So like I'm actually physically allergic to dairy. Like it makes me sneeze and stuff. So I just don't eat that. And like everybody in my family is allergic to it. So just like, I don't want to feel sick. I'm not going to eat that. So it doesn't go in the blog. And I have a probably minor wheat intolerance that just makes me feel bad. Like I felt like I was developing IBS symptoms and I cut out eating wheat and I felt better. So I continue to eat that way. And the vegetarian thing with the blog is very much so me wanting to really strongly encourage people to eat more plants in their life. And I just think that plant-based foods are really healing and they tend to be lower acid and they tend to be anti-inflammatory and they can be just as delicious as animal-based foods, or if not just as delicious, like pretty high up there. I mean, everybody knows that like bacon is delicious, right? I don't eat bacon, but like people know that. And very few things have that same sort of flavor situation. So I'm not going to exaggerate and be like, spinach is as good as bacon. Like, that's not true. But, I just want to encourage people to feel really confident and happy in their plant-based food choices and to really find pleasure in those things instead of feeling like those foods are somehow diet foods or that they're somehow like giving something up, because to me they're not at all. Like I am super happy with the way that I eat, and I eat very few animal-based anythings, and I want other people to feel that way, so that's why I write that way.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the things that I love the most about your blog is that you still make this way of eating seem really decadent and like you're treating yourself all the time. And I love that because I feel like so often that kind of eating is, it's like about depriving yourself, you know?
You're so right. And it makes me really just like bummed.
Yeah.
It bums me out that people feel like, oh, I gotta eat some spinach today, or oh, I gotta eat this vegetarian meal. Like when I was living with my parents right after college, I couldn't find a job living with my parents, so I was cooking a lot for them, and I was cooking a lot of vegetarian meals for them. My dad is definitely a type of person who's like, You know, he has a lot of comfort foods and he likes to have meat with dinners and like that's what he does. And I was cooking for him at the time and like he was so happy with what I was making him. He didn't have like any qualms with it at all. And that to me was just like so rewarding. The fact that you can really find pleasure in eating plant-based foods, even if you do like still eat meat pretty regularly and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, that what you just said about finding pleasure, it actually leads me to my next question really well, because you wrote a statement about your philosophy on food, which again, readers can go find in your about section on your blog. But what I love is that it makes you sound like a really joyful person. So is this your natural state or did it take a little bit of work to reach what seems to be such a good place?
I haven't always been the way that I am now. I think that now it feels like a natural state of exploring joy and exploring contentment and beauty and trying to absorb as much goodness out of life as possible. But I had anxiety issues in college to the point where I almost dropped out in my freshman year. And a lot of that had to do with like, you know, everybody has their own stuff, right? So I was having some anxiety problems that a lot of which had to do with like feeling very perfectionistic and I just needed to deal with them. So I was really, really sad during that time in my life. But, you know, anxiety, like sort of anxiety depression is different than like a more like chemical depression, which is actually sort of an apathetic experience of your life. Anxiety depression is more, I would say, emotional, very emotional. And it's something that a lot of people in my family deal with. And so part of the reason that I did that hike, which I mentioned earlier in Spain, did that hike, was that I really, I felt that I really needed to participate in something that was going to help me to intensely deal with the stuff that was going on inside of me and to be very aware with it and be very, I don't know, like kick myself in the ass, if you will, like kick myself in the butt to deal with all of the stuff that goes on from just the, you know, manifold experience of all the things that we stuff into our minds and our hearts and don't deal with, which I felt like I dealt with a lot of it during that journey. And I mean, no doubt that journey was like the most painful thing I've ever done. Like I physically was in pain. It was very, very difficult. So I've done a lot of things to deal with and become aware of what's going on inside of me. So, you know, my yoga practice, which is pretty much daily, I meditate. I did that massive, crazy hike. I try to surround myself with a really positive community of people, which I think is extremely important. If not like the most important thing. I'm also in an extremely happy, positive relationship right now, which is like definitely can't forget to mention that. I'm extremely thankful about it. And we're very supportive of each other. And having that sort of love relationship can really put you in a position where you can experience more joy, less pain. not that, you know, everything's like happy-go-lucky. I mean, we both sit down and are dealing with each other's stuff and challenging each other to be better. And like, you know, I'm definitely not perfect. He's definitely not perfect. But we experience a lot of goodness out of that process. And I have done therapy, you know, I don't do this all by myself. I'm not like, I've got a great idea, I'm going to go walk to Spain. But I definitely done therapy and have very supportive friends. So all these different things, but I feel like at this point in my life, a lot of the joy that I've experienced has to do with like, you know, going deep and sitting down with my own thoughts and allowing for more space between my thoughts. So I'm not totally identified with everything that I do, with every action that I take. I have a sort of, or at least I try, this is what meditation is for. You have more space to in your life generally to find peace and stillness, even in times that are perhaps a little bit more bumpy along the road.
Definitely. I mean, thank you for sharing that. That is very honest and forthcoming of you, so I appreciate that. I mean, it's kind of refreshing to know that you weren't just born this way and it just comes so naturally to you, because it really does seem effortless. So I think it's refreshing and almost relieving to know that it's something you have to work at, because it makes everyone else feel better too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of why I love teaching yoga, is just like allowing people, you know, a moment in their day to have that experience of stillness, even if it's just a second in their practice. 1 second of stillness is better than no seconds, and it's a daily thing, so you really have to do it every day, or 6 days a week to really get the benefits. And no doubt that's something that I've learned getting older, is that joy is something that you have to hold on to really, really fiercely, and to do that you have to have sort of an awareness of it every day.
Life just gets more full and more serious. And more serious. It sounds like then yoga became more of a focal point for you during that time in your life when you're trying to work through all of that difficult stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy, and my study was Indian philosophy, so I got kind of deep into it in a more unusual way for an undergraduate degree. Sort of was heading towards like getting a master's and going on to get my PhD, and just didn't really go in that direction. I just discovered that I have more of a creative art brain, and that I just need to accept that and be okay with that and try to live my reality within my brain instead of trying to be somebody else's brain. But yoga was pretty foundational for me, especially the philosophy of yoga. And I got more into the postural practice a little bit later. I mean, I was doing the postural practice when I was in my early 20s, and had been doing it before that sort of on and off. But I just sort of started incorporating it more, and it's definitely like ramped up over the years. So now I'm just like full bore, full steam ahead, if you will, on the yoga train.
I mean, yoga is something that I'm somewhat new to it, like within the last couple of years, but I'm truly addicted to it now, and it's helped me uncover a lot about myself. I mean, like, I firmly believe it's an important part of my self-development, but it's, you know, I don't think my experience is unique in that. I think that's why it's become such a big thing.
I hope that's why it's become a big thing. I really hope that. I really hope it's because people are becoming more conscious and happy.
Well, I hope so too. I mean, I guess there's other things, other motivators perhaps.
Oh, totally.
My altruistic one.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, yeah, everyone's getting happier and more conscious. Cool, yoga is expanding. But except that in reality, I know that it's not all like that. A lot of yogic practice is not all like that, and there's definitely a lot of ego.
Yes.
So, but that's okay. That's okay. I'll come around.
Exactly. Yeah. So, what place does yoga have in your everyday life right now? I mean, like, it sounds like you said 6 days a week, and that's what you need to do to get the main benefit from it.
There's a belief in the practice, the style that I practice, which is Ashtanga Vinyasa yoga, which is what pretty much all modern vinyasa stems off of, that you get the most benefit when you're practicing every day, but you can take a rest day. And they don't practice on what's moon days, so days when there's a full moon. And women don't practice when they're on their cycle, so like there's some rest, right? But I personally find that I get the most benefit when I practice almost every day. And when I say practice, I don't mean that I always do like the Ashtanga Vinyasa series every single day. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because I'm relatively new to Ashtanga Vinyasa. Relatively new. So I'm trying to ease my body into the practice since it's it can be very difficult, and you just have to be careful with your alignment and your knees and your hips and stuff like that. So I think generally, just like for the general population, the best thing you can do is try to do it every day. And a lot of it has to do with developing habits and developing a positive relationship with the physical practice so that you're like craving it and really want to be doing it for the benefit of yourself, your whole body. Even if that means just like doing some slow stretches every day, and doing like 5 minutes of meditation. That to me is just really a really, really great way to get into it. Even if you're just doing like 15 minutes of stretching and doing like 5 minutes of intentional breathing or meditation, that can create enough space that you can like build off of that over time. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of my students are like intro students and or older, like 50 or older. So, which I love teaching them. So I do a lot of trying to like introduce people to the practice and make it non-intimidating and help people to find that space to really like find the things that feel good in their body.
I mean, that all sounds amazing. And I love that also that you shared that you are okay with taking it slow and being easy on your body rather than just diving in and getting like focused on the athleticism of it. So
Yeah. I mean, yoga is designed to get your body prepared for meditation.
Yes.
The point of yoga.
I think we forget that.
What?
I think people forget that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not taught that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, a student can't remember that if they've never been taught that. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's not mentioned. People, the teachers particularly, not all teachers, obviously, but some teachers just, it's not really something that they particularly feel is their responsibility to teach to students. But for me, especially with introductory students, I always try to like explain that you're supposed to be finding space in your body, like slowly be developing into the different asanas, the different postures, so that you can find that ease when you're in a seated position, so that your hips are open, so that your spine is in alignment, so your shoulders are relaxed, and you can sit confidently for at least 10 minutes. I mean, at least 10 minutes, right? So like in yoga, they want you to be prepared to sit all day for meditation. Yeah. But there are a lot of like, I guess you'd say schools, but they're more like esoteric offshoots of yoga that have you do those things, which are not particularly necessary. Like sitting in meditation for 12 hours is torturing your body. Like that's what it is. No question. Your body does not want to be doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's awesome. Thank you for that reminder and for sharing that. I love that that's part of your philosophy. My trick, my main struggle is fitting it in. I found that I had, you know, I didn't know how much freedom and flexibility I had until I had a baby. Now I struggle with finding the time and also the energy and the mental space and all of that. But it's, I mean, it's getting easier for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all phases in your life, and that's all that it is, right?
Yeah, I could agree with that. Yeah. We all go through like phases and different times in our lives, and we have different challenges. And being a mother is, especially to a young one, is like one of the most challenging things you can do. One of the most amazing things you can do, but definitely one of the most challenging. I mean, that's how we all know that women are really, really strong.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. So I want to talk about two other things. So one is being chocolate.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but before I do that, I wanted to ask a question about your creative process. So I don't know, I'm kind of jumping backwards a little bit and going back into your blog, but maybe it extends to yoga too, or all that you do. But I loved that you wrote that your recipes often begin in the dream world. Like you know, you write slippery, gossamer, and liquid, and tasted only in the depths of sleep. I mean, gosh, what a thing.
Oh man, I literally just wrote that like the other day.
Really?
Yeah, I just wrote the other day, and I was just like, yeah, that's right. That's exactly what happened. So,
crazy. So can you talk about that a little bit? Yeah. Like, the process of extracting, dreaming of flavors or yolk or whatever it is that you're putting into a tangible thing. Like, I love that.
Yeah. So I wrote that in my bio because that does happen. And as far as, like, dreaming things that I want to make, and sometimes they're daydreams or whatever it is. Usually I just sort of like go off for daydreams. I like will sort of like start staring at the wall for like 10 minutes and I'm like, I got it, you know, like I know what I'm making or whatever it is. But I like to sort of think of, or a lot of creative work for me comes out in quiet times, like dreaming, daydreaming, going for walks, early hours of the morning and late at night. So like, it's not like only those times, but some of my best work comes during those times. And that's like for music, for writing, for, coming up with recipes. A lot of like the best stuff comes up during those times. So, yeah, like for dreams, I've definitely had dreams about very specific foods that I want to make. And sometimes they're like not realistic because it's a dream. And those, like, maybe the donut in my dream was made of, like, I don't know, something that's not edible, like what's edible in my dream. So I'm just like, oh yeah, like cedar spiced asparagus donuts or something. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But, and I'm exaggerating, but usually they come out, you know, as something that's like semi-workable or just sort of fun to play with conceptually. Otherwise, my creative work, when it's not sort of coming from this very like clear space where inspiration is just like dropping into my brain, which is like the best way to create, it feels best. A lot of it comes from the process of just like free writing. So I'll just like sit down with my journal on my computer and I'll just like write until something comes to me, until I write something that I feel really, really hits me and makes me feel like, yes, that definitely that thing is something that I want to make or something that I'm really excited about. Okay. And I might go back over that list later and decide some of those things I wrote down were like, you know, it's not really that great, but I can like circle 1, 2, 3 things that I'm excited about. And I'll put on my list of things to make or write about or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of mainly the way that I get creative inspiration, other than working with other people, because I really love and find a lot of inspiration in just inviting friends over to cook with me. And my friend Annabeth, who I've mentioned on the blog maybe a couple of times, she's a musician, and she comes over and she always has really fun, rad ideas about food. Because she reads a lot of like raw food stuff and like vegan stuff, and she always has like really fun ideas. So sometimes we'll just like sit around and jam about different ideas for food things. And those will often get combined with other thoughts I have in my head from blogs I'm being inspired by and just like mishmash into something really cool. Yeah.
It's really non-linear then.
Oh, yeah. Not linear at all.
No, I love it. And I love that you found a way to tap into it and pay attention enough that you can remember what those ideas are. I mean, I don't know. Okay. I feel like
I definitely forget stuff.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, for the most part, clearly you're figuring it out, which is cool. I don't even think I dream.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Maybe it's just the depth of my exhaustion. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't think I dream. Anyway, It's like a rare, rare morning that I wake up and I'm like, oh yeah, I had this dream last night. No, it never happens.
Yeah. I started taking this really, should I even say this in the podcast? This is so silly. Maybe it's not silly. I started taking this tincture. It has reishi mushrooms and motherwort and chamomile. And it's like before I go to sleep. And it really like has improved the quality of my dreams. So that's just like a curious little thing that I do. And I just take it to relax me before bed, and because it makes my dreams better.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy dreaming. It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Absolutely. But, I don't know why I don't dream, but anyway.
Who knows? Who knows why we dream or don't dream? Yeah, maybe you're just like super deep into REM sleep or something. You're just like out, need to get as much nourishing rest as possible.
So just the last thing I wanted to ask you about was chocolate. So I don't know if this is something that you talk about a lot on your blog. It doesn't seem like it comes up too often, but it's something that you're developing in the background, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a background thing. I don't talk about it a whole lot on the blog.
So is that because it's just, it's still...
It's just like... at the point now where it's just taking a frustratingly long time.
Okay, yeah.
But it's not so bad. I mean, it's not like going to make or break us or anything. So the company Frolic Chocolate is a bean to bar chocolate company, for those maybe listening who don't know. It's a bean to bar chocolate company. We make origin flavor bars, and each cacao bean has a sort of unique flavor depending on the region and the season, and we love that. So we make chocolate bars, and like the last thing we've got going on right now is we're finishing up our packaging, and pretty much everything is ready to go. We just need to finish up our packaging, so we're really excited. We've been working on it. I say we because Logan and I are working on it, but it's very much so Logan's baby.
Okay.
And Logan's my husband. So I am the creative side, and I help develop all the flavors, and I make sure that they all function really beautifully together, and that the packaging is beautiful, and I do all of the marketing and sort of the voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's the intention. Mm-hmm. And Logan is behind all the machines, roasting cacao beans and milling and making sure that all of our charts are correct, because he charts everything out and like creates very specific scientific profiles for each processing batch. And he's also a genius with money, so he's just like very financially aware, and he does that side of the business. So, yeah, it's coming up soon. We're really, really hoping we'll be able to launch by sort of mid-fall.
Okay.
That's literally what we said last year, too. So, yeah. But last year, we were not nearly as close as we are now. Now we have all of our machines. We have everything, you know, except for our packaging. So we're just waiting on that. And we're really excited about it. So we're also, as part of that company, we also roast coffee.
Oh, all right. I guess it's similar.
So we roast coffee and we brew cold brew, and we're planning on having bottled cold brew coffee coming out sometime soon.
Why don't I live closer to you?
Well, you know, our plans with the business are to have distribution available, but we'll see how realistic that is for the upcoming time. But, yeah, Logan loves coffee so much, and that's totally my fault. He never drank coffee before he met me, but he loves it, and we're really excited about it.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. So what drew you to chocolate initially? Like, how did you learn? How did you develop this?
Oh, we're very much so self-taught, and we were drawn to it when we first started dating in college because we got really into raw chocolate. You've like heard of raw chocolate. Raw chocolate's like, oh, it's unprocessed and it's very expensive. It's very expensive. And you can get it in health food stores and stuff like that. We're pretty stoked about it. But we and we were planning on like launching this sort of like raw chocolate company, raw truffles, whatever, and totally backed off of that subject, that whole concept, once we started traveling and becoming aware of bean to bar chocolate. Okay. And how much better it tasted. Like, it tastes so much better. It has such an interesting flavor profile. And we also learned that raw chocolate is technically very rarely ever raw.
Yeah, well, it's not surprising.
Yeah, it's not that surprising. It's not a regulated term. And so pretty much anybody can sell, you know, something that's like raw chocolate. And I'm not saying that there aren't any companies that are really dedicated to that. Mm-hmm. But even just the very basic process of cacao going through fermentation, which it does naturally in tropical environments, which is where it grows, the fruit starts to ferment almost immediately as soon as it touches the air, essentially, and is removed from the pod. Mm-hmm. And it ferments, and it's generally fermented in large heaps, and the temperature that the cacao reaches kills the germinating seed within the bean. It's quite hot. It's far above raw. So it sort of has a mild cooking process just naturally. And you have to have that in order to develop flavor within the cacao. So sometimes I could keep talking about this forever. Oh my God. Sometimes like a handful of companies have started to wash the fruit off of the cacao to keep it from fermenting, which to me is like, whoa, that's such a bummer. Like, the fermentation brings so much amazing flavor. So the ultimate product is perhaps not as delicious as it could be. And to me, cacao is like one of these amazing foods, like coffee. It's just such a special food, you know, and it's expensive. So you want to get the best flavor quality and mouthfeel and all these different things that are involved in like a chocolate bar that you can get. So yeah, we just transitioned to bean to bar after we just discovered that, and we started getting really obsessed with different bean to bar brands and origins and learning tons about it. And I studied at Ecole Chocolat, which is like an online chocolate school, and so did Logan. And learned a lot about the process, and we've just been really nerdy about research. And it's really hard to research the process because it's something that is so new on the scene. You know, like how, like, roasting coffee now, there's a ton of information about it. And that's because Starbucks, like, Starbucksified the coffee world and made sort of origin coffee and specialty coffee really, really popular. So now it's really accessible information, but it's not very accessible for chocolate. No. So you really have to like dig deep, which is part of why it's taken us so long to get this off the ground, because like we really want to know what we're doing and be producing like the best chocolate that we possibly can.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think what most people think of as chocolate is barely chocolate.
Oh.
It's just so processed and so, I mean, everything. So what is the bean to bar process? Like, what does that mean exactly? So you're just taking...
It's a little complex, but I only say that because it's just a lot of steps. It's not hard. It's just a lot of steps.
Right. So, but like, generally, it just mean like you're taking your everything. So you take the bean from its most basic form as you receive it and then taking it all the way
through. Yeah, yeah, I'll explain it. So we receive the cacao once it's been fermented and dried. So it's a dry cacao bean that I call them beans, so they're technically like seeds, but they're sort of the shape of an almond. And they have a papery husk around them, not dissimilar from, say, like hazelnuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little bit thicker than that, but, you know, basic idea. And so when we get the cacao, you know, we go through it, we sort it, we like clean it, we make sure that there's no detritus just in the, you know, batch of beans that we've got. And we roast the cacao. We have an airbed roaster, which basically means the cacao floats in sort of air while it's being roasted at a specific temperature. And we roast it And then we winnow it. So winnowing, we crack the bean, and then we winnow the shells off of it. We basically blow the shells off of the cacao. Okay. And then after that, we take the nibs, the little bits of cacao, yep. We put them through what is essentially a peanut butter grinder, but that's just an extra step that we do. And we put it into our melangeur, which is a stone grinding machine, and it breaks the cacao nibs down into a paste, like a liquid, to a very tiny size, so you get that really smooth texture, and we add sugar to the batch.
Okay.
And then after that, so you see all the steps, we conch it, which gets all the volatile acids off of it, which creates a more mild cacao, mild like chocolate, because chocolate can be very, very bitter. It has a lot of these volatile acids in it, which just release out into the air when you put a certain amount of heat onto the liquid chocolate as it's moving. And then we temper it, which changes the structure of the crystals in the chocolate to something called type 5 or V crystals, which when you then pour it into the bar molds, results in a bar that ultimately has this nice snap. It's very shiny. The cacao butter and the cacao solids in the chocolate bar are all like melded really well together. So if you've ever seen a chocolate bar that's sort of like, it's got sort of a milky white look to it, or a chocolate bar has, say, melted and then reformed, and you see like the white cacao butter on the outside, there's nothing wrong with the chocolate. It's just lost its type 5 or V crystal shape within the crystal structure of the chocolate. And that's it. Wow. We package it, and that's it.
It's so interesting to me. I mean, gosh, I really love chocolate too, so that helps. But what are some of the, just quickly, I have two more questions left for you. So what are the main key benefits of eating good chocolate?
Other than it making you very happy.
Yeah, the emotional aspect.
Emotionally happy. There are a lot. There are a couple of different chemicals in chocolate, which I don't really know how to explain it in an incredibly, like, intelligent way. I feel like it's been a while since I've talked about this out loud. But so there are natural chemicals in chocolate, theobromine and anandamide, which are both chemicals which essentially produce a happiness effect in the system, in the brain. So theobromine is sort of cognate to caffeine, but it has more of a slow process in the body. So you don't get that like really super high caffeine high and then crash. You just sort of like is a slow upper effect, and it relaxes the blood vessels and it relaxes the heart. So it can be good if you are experiencing anxiety or stress. So it relaxes the blood vessels. And anandamide specifically, as far as I can remember, has very much so something to do with releasing serotonin and releasing sort of bliss chemicals. That's why they call it anandamide. So ananda in Hindi is the word for bliss.
Okay.
The bliss chemical. So those are some of the more, to me, the things that come up in my mind. Obviously, there are tons of antioxidants, an incredibly high amount of antioxidants in chocolate. And cocoa butter, I mean, I find cocoa butter is very good for your skin, whether you take it internally or you rub it on your skin. So people shouldn't be afraid of cocoa butter. Cocoa butter is good for you. It's an amazing food.
I mean, I didn't realize that it had those. It's so like the pleasure of eating chocolate goes beyond just the taste of it. It's actually a chemical thing too. It's just fascinating.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Yeah, it just totally blows my mind. Which is part of why Logan and I have continued to be so, like, obsessed with it. You know, it's one of the most amazing food as medicines that exists on the planet, in my mind.
Oh, so fascinating. Yeah. And none of those benefits or antioxidants or anything are destroyed during the processing of the bean. Like, it stays all intact.
As far as I know, yeah, they're not destroyed. I mean, I've looked at some studies based, like, you know, comparing raw and cooked. Which, by the way, there's actually not that much science on chocolate generally, if you didn't know. It's a very, very new school of study. And the University of Hawaii is one of the only universities studying it actively right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they are doing some really interesting work over there. But back to what I was saying. Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of antioxidants in chocolate. And should also be noted that chocolate is not roasted at a high temperature. It's a very low temperature. You know, it's in the low 200s. Okay. So it's, I mean, it's comparable to, like, drying fruit, like eating dried fruit. Dried fruit is often, like, heated in the low 200s.
Yep.
So, and you lose very little, like, benefit from actually cooking it at that heat. It's a very, like, sensitive food. Cacao is very sensitive. So you don't want to heat it too high or it will, like, burn and lose a lot of those wonderful flavor qualities.
Yep. Yeah. So interesting. So then my very last question about chocolate is, how can people recognize good chocolate versus not so good, highly processed and sugary?
Well, the first thing you can do is look at the ingredients list.
Well, that's
right. Fair. So like for someone who might be a total beginner, like you flip the chocolate bar over, you look at the ingredients list and you check in to see if there's something like soy lecithin in the chocolate bar. Now, a lot of chocolate bars use soy lecithin as emulsifier so that it doesn't melt so quickly or so that it's more stable. Soy lecithin, there's nothing really wrong with soy lecithin, but there's often like a whole lot of other things in your chocolate besides soy lecithin. So you really just want to avoid those completely unless maybe there's like some milk in it or something. If you want to consume dairy or that's part of the way that you eat, that's fine. But, looking at the sugar content as well, like, to me, dark chocolate is generally the best. If for your health, the darkest chocolate is always going to be the best. So you don't really want the sugars to spike your, like, insulin levels or anything. So I always go for, like, 70% or higher.
Okay.
And going for chocolate usually that states an origin. This is totally just how I pick chocolate. This is not like everybody should do it this way. But I tend to choose chocolate bars that tell me the origin so I have an idea of like what the flavor profile might be. A lot of the larger brands of chocolate don't list the origin, and that's fine. They use blends of beans. And there's nothing wrong with that. But some of the best chocolate that you can get as far as like flavor and quality, they usually list the origin. They're usually a higher percentage of chocolate to sugar, 60% or above.
Yeah.
The Bean de Bar brands don't usually have soy lecithin, and they usually only have listed as like cacao, sugar, maybe cocoa butter.
Okay.
That's about it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's easy.
Yeah.
Is cacao, do they have a lot of the similar problems as coffee with sustainability, or is there something?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I typically try not to buy chocolate from Africa. Not across the board, because there are definitely some companies that I very much so trust, like Askinosi, for example. They have a handful of different African origin chocolate bars. Or chocolates that they get from Africa, and they are extremely dedicated to sustainability and providing proper compensation to farmers, which I think is really important because there's a lot of exploitation in chocolate, especially from the very big brands, And currently, I believe this is the case, 2 mega conglomerates own almost all of the chocolate in the world. So you can imagine the amount of bureaucracy involved and how the farmer, the person all the way at the bottom of the supply chain, is thought of the least. When you have companies that big, it's very hard to control where your raw product is coming from. So a lot of the chocolate, I'm not going to say that like these companies particularly know 100%. I'm not going to say that they don't intentionally not want to know, like they don't ask the questions. But they tend to get chocolate from, or raw cacao beans, from sort of like huge co-ops. And the co-ops are responsible for buying the cacao. So a lot of farmers, or like a co-op might buy from another small group of people, and those people buy from the farmers. So there's not a whole lot of oversight of what's actually happening at the farmer level. And so you definitely end up with things like child labor and slavery and things like that. And it's such a huge market in Africa. It's such a high value product that like there's a lot of exploitation involved. So I generally try to buy chocolate from Central and South America and from small countries and from companies that I trust generally, that I trust their sourcing practices. There's definitely issues within the industry, big issues.
So, yeah, again, usually it just boils down to buying from someone small that you trust because they have more control over the whole process. So,
yeah, there's more control over the supply chain, which is one of the most important elements of dealing with any imported high-value product.
Right, exactly. That's very true. Yeah, well, I mean, thank you for all that information, Renee,
yeah.
And it's amazing talking with you. I really appreciated all your time.
Oh, yeah, it's such a pleasure.
So that concludes my talk with Renee. I told you there was a lot going on in that interview, right? I hope you enjoyed it and feel inspired by Renee's words and ideas. As always, we've prepared show notes for you over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Renee. Make sure to check out the links to Renee's past features on Pure Green, especially her most recent in-season creation, and definitely bookmark her blog if you aren't already a reader. You'll be hooked from the first moment. One last thing before I go, if you enjoyed today's episode of the podcast, please take a few minutes to leave a review for us on iTunes. It makes a big difference in helping new listeners discover the show. I'm truly grateful for your support and listenership. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast.